Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio's Labyrinths in the News. Today is the 22nd day of the Electric Deer Moon of Service, Dali Crown Chakra, White Self-Existing World Bridger Day. The affirmation is, I define in order to equalize, measuring opportunity. I seal the store of death with the self-existing tone of form. I am guided by the power of spirit. It's also Gregorian calendar, Monday, October 11th, 2010, and my daughter's birthday. Happy birthday, Melina. I'm your host, Christiana, coming to you live from the Couve, that's Vancouver, Washington, across the river from Portland, Oregon. The schedule for my show is a little more fluid now due to my other responsibilities and my guest schedules as well. So please check online both on the Blog Talk Radio website and on Labyrinth Network Northwest's website, as well as on mine, Turning Tide Energetics, for the most up-to-date listings. My leading music is the first cut, Icos, short for icosahedron, the water symbol in sacred geometry, off of Susan Alexander's CD, Sequentia. If any of you would like to chat while we're on the air, please go to Christiana-Anea at blogtalkradio.com. My guest today is Mary Keeter, a needlework and bead artist and craftsperson who will be one of the concurrent workshop presenters at this year's Labyrinth Society gathering in November in New Harmony, Indiana. Thank you, Mary, for joining me today.
Hi, Christiana. Happy to be here.
So, you're on the West Coast?
That's right. I'm in San Francisco.
Okay. Yeah, not too far away from me.
Not that far,
no. No, not really. Hope you're having, but we're having a sunny day here. We'll take it. The rain has started, and we're expecting, you know, nonstop rain, but it's sunny today. So I as soon as my Blog Talk Radio show is over, I'm getting out in the sun.
Tell us
a bit about your craft, about this, the bead craft of beadwork, and how did you find your way to incorporating labyrinth design, or how did you find your way to labyrinth through your passion as an artist, or did you do that?
Well, yes, I did. I've enjoyed needlework since I was 10, and that's always included beading. About 8 years ago, I learned the peyote stitch beading technique, which is amazingly versatile. And you don't need a loom to do it. And that's really what led me into labyrinths.
Okay, so what's a peyote stitch?
Well, with a loom, your beads form a two-way grid, all rectangles all lined up. But with peyote stitch, it looks more like brickwork. And so the pattern gives you a three-way grid. And in my first experiment with designing for a peyote stitch, I came up with a pretty hexagonal double spiral pattern, and I can chart a strip for beading just six beads across. There really isn't time to go into all the details, but it's so versatile that I charted it for as many as 20 beads across and up to 12 colors, and then I wanted to make necklaces out of these pretty things. And
so, okay, so wait, stop. First of all, I need a sense of what you're talking about here. So do you have a piece of fabric, and then you have what size are the beads?
Well, they're called 11 O's. They're about 2 millimeters across.
Okay.
Pretty small.
And then you don't string them on string. You string them in a a pattern that you already have, like on a needlework pattern?
Yeah.
No.
Thread path looks like rickrack.
Okay.
Yeah, it's hard to explain.
Okay. And how wide is it? How wide are the strips that you use?
The little ones are about a quarter of an inch wide, and the big ones are about an inch wide.
Okay. Okay, and that's like a standard beadwork size? I mean, are these mostly used for necklaces, or what are they used for?
They're used for jewelry. They have many applications. That particular size is the most popular ones, and so the manufacturers make the most colors for that.
Okay. And so can I just ask, so you've been a beadwork person, you've been an artist, a needlework artist since you're a child. Did you go to college? You have a degree in mathematics. I'm asking this because this whole process is very mathematical, which is wonderful. And so do you have a mathematics background, or were you a teacher of math? Or?
No, I majored in English. I was terrified of math. I did high school algebra and geometry, and really that was it.
Okay. And Mary, could you make sure that you're up close to the microphone
Sure.
so we can hear you, because you're fading a little bit. So
oh, sorry
keep
about
yourself
that. Is that better?
That's great. That's perfect.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, so if you make a lot of connections and you take steps that, to me, like I'm a rank novice when it comes to needlework or beading, and the steps seem arbitrary, like creating a labyrinth with no axis and then moving labyrinths and getting rid of the spine, central spine. Can you please explain this a little bit and have the process? So now you have this peyote stitch, and
mm-hmm.
then you're going, oh, I can make labyrinths with this. What
yep.
made you then go to the, so explain.
Well, it comes back to the peyote stitch again. The first one that I altered was the Chartres labyrinth. At first I thought I'd chart it just exactly the way it is with the four arms of the cross. But as I looked at the thing, I saw that the Chartres labyrinth uses, there are 10 pairs of labyrinths on the two secondary axes, and so I wondered if I could move them so that they would align with the three axes of the hexagon, and it worked. I could put two of them in each of those five spots. And other labyrinths were, of course, easy to convert to the hexagon shape. I actually ended up making two charts for each labyrinth, and that was interesting. And I collected about 40 labyrinth designs over this time, and I started seeing a progression of designs from, say, 3,500 years ago to the present. We start off with the classical or Cretan labyrinth, and it has a solid axis down the center. And then there are all those turns coming off just the axis. And then the second step is the Greco-Roman labyrinth, which have usually four axes. And again, all the turns are coming off the axes. And the path repeats as you move from one segment to the next. And then the third step is, of course, the medieval Christian labyrinth. And that's where the path really gets interesting, because you can go to the center, you come out to the edge, and then you go to the center again. And you have these secondary axes with the free labyrinths or floating labyrinths. And so I wondered if a labyrinth could be designed that didn't have a solid line axis. And that's it just looked like a wonderful puzzle. So I went at it.
Okay. And you used the hexagon shape rather than the circle because it fits into, I mean, because you're working with a piece of material that has line. I mean, it has edges. So the shapes have to fit in between the edges.
Yes, they do. It all comes back to the peyote stitch. And see, if I were to bead a labyrinth as a circle, it would be far more complex. I'd have to do it on a loom. And the charting is more complex with the curved path. But with the peyote stitch, all my paths are straight lines. Mm. And I basically said, what's not to like here?
Okay. And what made you, okay, so I'm going to go back because I still don't get the connection here. So where did you hear about labyrinths? What made you think, what made you say, oh, I can use this peyote stitch and put labyrinth designs and make labyrinth designs with the peyote stitch? When did you first start working labyrinths? And
you're familiar with Lauren Artress, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know about the Chartres labyrinth that she brought to San Francisco and
yes,
built one outside of Grace Cathedral and one inside.
Right.
And she had really been in the news a lot, and she's really the one who gave me the idea.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you're in San Francisco. You've been up to Grace and walked the labyrinth there, and so that's how it the whole process started. Okay. That was
yes,
a little piece that I was missing here. Okay, great. So you got rid of the axis, the spine, but what had you give up on you first designed spiral designs. So
that's
talk
right
about the spiral designs and what had you give up on spiral designs that you first did?
Well, they were certainly pretty, but they have a big drawback in that the path just goes into the center almost exactly the way a simple spiral does. What happened was that my turns would take you outward for a circuit or two, but then the path would just start going inward again. And so they weren't going to be as interesting as I wanted them to be. You're always aiming for something like the Chartres labyrinth when you're designing. And they required the they satisfy the first requirement, which was that they be attractive, but not the second one, which is the interesting path.
And so then you say here that you write in the information you gave me, so a well-designed labyrinth should have both a beautiful symmetry and a surprising path. And these are criteria you used to come up with what did this conclusion lead to?
Well, it meant that the spiral labyrinths, and that's basically what I was calling them, were a good start, but ultimately they were a dead end, and I designed only two or three dozen of them. And I basically had to start over, but they gave me a clue. And that's that a labyrinth without a solid line axis really needs to be designed using polygons and not circles. So I returned to the hexagon shape, and then I started getting where I wanted to go, but the labyrinths were little ones, just three or four circuits, and it's really kind of impossible to describe them. But I finally got past that would go to the innermost circuit and then out to the edge again before coming again to the center. And I spent a few months designing, several dozen of the little ones. And I did find three of them that were really the first ones that satisfied me. They were interesting paths. The symmetry was really nice. And they weren't repetitive.
And so you're doing these, and as you're doing them, you're looking at them from, first of all, from an artistic perspective, how are these beads, when you bead them, you put different colors on different paths, and so you also create a symmetry with the colors of the beads as well as the pattern itself?
Usually when I'm doing the labyrinth itself, I'm using only two colors, one for the outside, one for the path, and one for the walls.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. It makes it less complicated to see, to distinguish.
Yeah, much less complicated.
Got it. And so, all right, so hexagon means what? How many sides?
It's six-sided.
Okay. And just so people know that. Okay, so you've got a six-sided design here, and you're creating all sorts of different combinations of using this peyote stitch. And out of all the ones you created, you came up with three that fit the criteria, that had a beautiful symmetry and an interesting path. And then you say your process led to create double and triple labyrinths, putting one inside the other, but you still weren't satisfied. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay, here's where I got stuck again. Actually, the Cretan labyrinth is designed like that. It's really one small labyrinth inside another one with another circuit added right in the middle. And that's basically what I was doing with these little labyrinths, putting one of them inside the other. But once again, I'm running into the same problem that my path isn't able to go to the center and then all the way to the outermost circuit again before it comes in. But what happened while I was drawing these things, I started seeing these beautiful patterns in the turns as I combined the labyrinths. And that was really my first clue. And the second clue was in the Chartres labyrinth again. It looks symmetrical, but it actually isn't.
So what do you mean by the asymmetry of the Chartres labyrinth path design? Explain that.
Okay. Well, if you look at the two horizontal axes of Chartres, on the left axis, you've got the two innermost circuits just going right by the labyrinths. They're called through paths. And on the right axis, the two outermost circuits are doing the same thing. And that asymmetry and the difference, that's what makes the path that we all love, that carries us right to the inner circuit and then back to the edge before we come into the center.
And that's probably why there's more lunations on one side than the other, too, which
yes.
Robert Frey points out.
Yes.
So you took this asymmetry. So this was a jumping off point for you. So explain the module concept. And I know it's going to be difficult without pictures, but do the best you can. Explain this, what you mean. I mean, I know it has to do with a peyote stitch, but then you took all these things and came up with this concept.
Yeah, and the best way to explain it in this audio form is to go back to the Chartres labyrinth with those two axes, with the four axes, rather, forming a cross. Now, I want you to imagine two diagonal lines dividing the labyrinth into four quarters. And so you've got each axis centered in one of those four quarter circles. And the next step is look at the bottom quarter circle and divide it right along that solid line. So you have two eighth circles there at the bottom. And now what you're looking at is five modules. The left one and the top one and the right one are what I call side modules. And the two bottom ones are the left and right entrance modules. And once I figured that out, I saw that there can be a lot of variation in the modules. You look at the two left and right modules, and you have three labyrinths, that is three pairs of turns, and you have five through paths. And there are so many more variations than just the two in the Chartres labyrinth. And that's where the fun starts. And
so you took these, you took each one of these pieces of the module, or each one, each module, and started playing with it, the combinations inside each one.
That's right. That's right. And I made more combinations. And the first modules I made actually weren't like that, because I was still looking for that elusive one where you don't have a main axis, where every turn is free-floating. So actually the first ones I made looked like rhombuses, because I was still working with a hexagon. Now, if you put...
What is a rhombus?
Rhombus, yes. A rhombus is a diamond. It's a squashed square. If you took two edges of a square and squeezed them together, then you'd have the diamond shape that you find in a deck of cards.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, you with me?
Sorry for interrupting, but keep going. Yep.
Okay. So you put three rhombuses together, and you make a hexagon. And once I had the module concept, I pretty much arbitrarily picked a set of labyrinths. I was working with, I think, one labyrinth and three of the through paths. And I drew the variations on these little diamond-shaped slips of paper, and then I started playing with them one afternoon. And at the end of the afternoon, I had found 18 labyrinths, and I could pick the best one. I don't think anybody's done that before.
I don't think so. I don't think so. So, and the best one meaning the most interesting, the least boring, the most pleasing, all of the parameters that you've set up here—the beautiful symmetry and the surprising path. That's what your goal is.
Yes, and I had gotten there. I couldn't. I was that.
Keep
that on. Was a very good day.
Uh-huh, I bet. But, okay, so you've got all these separate modules, and you've got all these rhombuses, and you're putting them all together. But the modules, don't the modules have to connect together to the individual? And how did you know that these, you just played with all of these little pieces, like a puzzle, to where they would fit and connect one with the other?
That's right. What happens when you put them together is that a through path, say, will enter one side of a labyrinth and come out again, and it might even go into another labyrinth, and that one will go out through another module into a through path. It's really hard to describe, but it works.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I actually can see the picture of it. You're connecting. It's like a big giant puzzle, and
right.
Were you good at solving puzzles as a child?
I didn't think so until I really started doing this. And
your passion for this was changing your whole concept of who you were and what you were capable of doing.
Especially the math part.
Yes. So that leads me to my next question. So you have algorithmic formulas now that explain the, I guess you would say, progression or the of these modules. What do they provide?
Well, for those of people who are actually going to use the modules, you don't really have to worry about the algebra. The algebra mostly comes in because, well, I found my first monster set of modules when I was working on the six-circuit labyrinths, and the first monster I came up with had 15 side modules and 12 entrance modules, and I knew that I was looking at a lot of possible combinations, but I was trying to figure out just exactly what I was up against. And by this time, I wasn't just using three of these rhombuses to make a labyrinth. I was using six, and this is also very hard to describe, but I was overlapping them and leaving a big empty space inside so that I could really see the turns. And, well, what I came up with was if I used six modules for these things, there were over 4 million possible combinations, and I haven't even gone through any all of them. I've gone through 280,000 of them, and oh my, I think that took me 2 weeks.
Oh my golly.
Yeah, I'm doing it by hand.
How did you keep it all straight? Did you organize it on a computer, or did you just throw away the ones that absolutely didn't honor the prerequisites that you had set up, or do you have them all listed someplace? How do you keep it all straight?
Well, the first thing I did was start numbering the modules.
Uh-huh.
And so once you do that, it's pretty easy to keep track of them. You just methodically go through each combination, and it's really much less tedious than it sounds, because what happens is when you get two labyrinths to line up together, that's a closed loop, so you can discard that module. It won't work with that other module, and you just go on to the next one until you find one that does work, and that's the way it works.
So you spent many months drawing and beading. Did you actually, you were just drawing, but you weren't actually beading anything yet. You were just drawing all of the unicursal. So these are all unicursal single path designs.
That's right.
Correct? And
yeah.
At this point, how many did you have in existence?
Oh, my.
There
were over 1,000. There might have been 2,000 at that point. I was amazed.
That you liked, that met your criteria of beautiful symmetry and surprising path.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay,
and
so then you decided to experiment with multicursal patterns, so more than one path leading in to this labyrinth. What happened?
Well, of course, first I thought of bicursals, and I got the idea from those rad bicursal designs from Germany, and when I used the rhombus modules, I found these gorgeous labyrinths that they spiral into the center with one full turn around the labyrinth, and then they spiral outward in another full turn around the labyrinth, just like a spiral galaxy, so that's what I call them. And then I thought,
okay,
wait.
You mean one full turn around the center?
That's
and
right.
And then another full turn around?
To the outside again,
you
yeah.
You said labyrinth.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
So one full turn around the center and then another full turn around the outside. Got it, okay.
Yeah, just like a spiral galaxy.
Oh.
Yeah. I love that.
So then what'd you do?
Well, then I really went crazy. I thought, what if I put three entrance modules together? And it worked. And that's a tricursal.
So that's a tricursal pattern. So this is a tricursal. So what's possible with a tricursal? I mean, what were you thinking when you did this that it would be used for or could be used for?
Boy, I bet a lot of people will ask me, what was I thinking? For one thing, a tricursal isn't a labyrinth because you can't walk the entire area in a single trip through. You have to choose one entrance, you walk to the center, and then you have to choose one of the other two exits from the center and take that path to the outside, and you still haven't walked the third path. But, of course, a tricursal isn't a maze either because you can't get lost in one.
So we have to come up with a new term.
Yeah, well, tricursal will do for the moment.
Yeah, tricursal. Oh boy, this will be fun. Oh, this will be fun. We should have this as something at TLS where people put ideas into the hat, and we pick the best idea for the name.
That's probably a good idea. Tricursal is a little awkward.
Yeah. So what were you thinking? So you mentioned in your writing what you thought would be a wonderful use for this if you did an actual one that people could walk. And I love this image. So could you share that?
Yeah. The thing with a tricurricle, frog in throat. See, two people can walk a tricurricle together. Each one chooses an entrance, and they each take their separate paths to the center, and then when they get to the center, something happens in the center, and then they take the third path out, like commitment ceremonies, weddings, things like that.
Yeah. I just love that vision, that image. That it was what a great idea and how pretty. I mean, you could so I have so many questions, but I'm going to keep going here because we only have 15 minutes. So you're going to be sharing this information, and you're going to have lots of slides. You're doing the whole PowerPoint presentation at the TLF gathering?
Yes. I'm really looking forward to it.
And are you going to be – so have you actually done a lot of – do you have a finished product? Are you going to be selling beadwork pieces at the gathering?
Yes, I have some necklaces, and I'll also have designs that I charted. So if anybody wants me to make a piece for them, I can do that. And since I have so many designs, I decided that I'm never going to make any two necklaces alike.
And the necklaces are just plain, do they slip over the head, or are they attached at the back? What do they look like?
Well, they're in three pieces connected by a bead so that they can move better. And there's a clasp at the back.
And how wide are they? You use the quarter inch or the one inch?
Well, for the little ones, I use the six bead strap, and I try to proportion them so that a larger labyrinth will have a wider strap.
Okay, and could you do this whole idea with belts? Could you make belts out of it?
Gee, I don't know. I haven't really thought about that.
I mean, it would seem to me it would lend itself beautifully to belts and just a thicker width, or you could have skinny belts. I mean, that's very popular
belts nowadays.
Yeah,
the strap designs would certainly work like that.
Mm-hmm. So you've created patterns. So are you gonna have patterns to sell? For those of us like myself who are mathematically challenged, I might be kind of interested in putting beads together and making a necklace for myself, but I know that I am not going to check out those patterns.
I will bring some charts along, yeah. And, well, basically, you know, I really want these to be used, and I have made one that's walkable, one labyrinth, that is, and what I'd like to see happening is to have every place a labyrinth built have its own unique design that's made just for that place and the people using it. And you remember Ron Esquivel's talk on sacred geometry last year? I think sacred geometry is going to really be brought into play here.
And how does that relate to your labyrinth design?
Because of the versatility of it. You see, the harmony labyrinths, that's what I'm calling the hexagonal labyrinths that don't have a solid axis. They don't work just with hexagons. You can use any polygon for this. So you could make a labyrinth using a square or a pentagon or a septagon or an octagon, anything. It'll work for all of them. So you select the sides, you select the number of sides, and you select the number of circuits, and you select the number of modules you're going to use. That's three numbers right there. that you can put into play in one of these labyrinths.
And so the whole idea of the number 3 and the number 4 and the number 7 and 11 and 12 that shows up in nature, which makes the sacred geometry what it is, or with the term that's what it's used, shows up repeatedly in these polygonal designs.
Yes, it does. It's going to be really fun.
And you said you made one on the floor. What was it? So you actually have one that you designed that's with this method, this modular method. Where is that?
Well, it's on the terrace above my garage, and I walk it once or twice a week. It's one of the first of those little four circuit designs that I was really happy with.
And it has no central spine.
It has no central spine. That's right.
And so it's actually, so it doesn't look like, I mean, you think of four circuit. When I think of a three circuit or a five circuit, it's very simple. It's like a, you know, it's just three passes and you're in the center. But because it has no spine, it's actually more complicated. You get to meander a little bit.
You get to meander an amazing amount. Yeah.
Lots of turns.
Lots of turns.
Is it challenging? How wide is the path?
With this one? Well,
On my deck.
Actually, I think they're only about 6 or 7 inches across. It's barely walkable.
Mm.
They really should be larger, but I wanted one.
Right, I got it. So you just put this. And what did you use to create this? What materials did you use?
3-inch square tiles.
Uh-oh.
The walls are black, and the path is gray.
And so the walls are made out of what?
Black tiles.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
So you put black tile and then the 3-inch for the path and, like, okay. And is there anything, cement or anything keeping it together?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't
make it myself. We were building a garage for our house, and so we needed a terrace anyway. So I thought, hey, why not use this design?
In the terrace.
Yes, that's
right. So at this point, you've created over 4,000, you told me, 4,000 labyrinth designs?
That's right.
Oh, my golly.
4,000. That's the power of this. And I'm only getting started.
Did you get a chance to talk to Ron Escoval when he was in Troutdale? Because I'm sure he was interested in all of this and what you were doing.
A little bit, yes. Just a little bit.
And will you have beads for sale? Are you going to offer these as like kits where you can sell the beads and...
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about doing that because I really do want each one to be unique. I want nobody to have two necklaces alike. So if I did do kits, I would have to tailor them to each person.
Okay. And all right. So explain to me why. So if you have over 4,000 designs. So what is that about these that has you feel this way rather than thinking of it in terms of, you have 4,000 designs. If you make, you take 20 of the designs and you make it available, why is it so important that each person have their own design?
Well, I suppose it might not be for them, but I just kind of like the idea of everyone having their unique labyrinth. I would do it that way if people really want me to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what is so okay? So I'm not going to go on another talk here. You do this because you do this because you love doing the bead work and you love creating new designs. Is this a commercial, or do you see this as a commercial venture in any way?
I have sold the necklaces. I've sold quite a few of them, as a matter of fact. The jewelry market is really competitive, especially in this economy. So I've had them in and out of shops, and mostly right now I'm selling them to family and friends, and I'm still looking for shops. I joke to people that I've been turned down in all the best places in San Francisco. It's rough out there.
Well, I was like, so when you have presented these in the shops, are they a couple of different designs, or are they the same design, or just different bead colors? I mean, how are you doing if you want everybody to have their own design, but then you're looking to sell them in shops? Are you restricting the ones that you're selling in shops to certain designs, or how is that working? I mean, I'm asking this question because for people who are artists and are selling their labyrinth artwork, these kinds of things come up. These kinds of questions come up, and I know we have a basic script that we're going on, and I'm asking you a lot of things that are on this because it's, what's coming up for me is trying to be helpful to other people who are artists, and these kinds of questions come up. What do I do in this case?
Yeah, what do you do? Well, what I've done is I restricted myself to metallics and white and gray and black, and really that gave me a lot of variation. And if I make necklaces just like that, those necklaces will go with everything. And there are, I figured out 40 different colorways right there. So I can take one labyrinth design, and I can bead it using those 40 different colorways and never repeat myself.
Mm.
And then I've got 4,000 designs. Well, you do the math.
Right, right. Okay. All right. That explains it a little bit. That's very helpful because I just great. I understand now. And so you're coming up against how to sell this, how to get this information out. Do you have a website?
Not yet. Once again, I'm running up into the whole problem of the fact that I want to do just one-of-a-kind designs. Now, one of my friends suggested that I just post each one as I make it, and when I sell that one, the photo comes down. I think that should work.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I also just want to put the raw designs up so that people who want to make labyrinths can have access to the designs themselves. And that is going to take a lot of work.
Right. Well, you're going to have to. It would seem to me that you're going to have to copyright every single one of these because you're the one that created these. So you have copyright issues and that. And that's not a difficult thing to do. But then is it copyrightable because you're just extrapolating on? So that's, yeah, you have some. So this is what's next for you? What's coming up for you is figuring all of this out?
It's figuring all of this out. It's getting the copywriting done. And what I'd really like to do is find somebody who can write a computer program for using the modules, because, as I said, I'm doing this all by hand right now, just mm-hmm. playing with these little pieces of paper, and you know, it's really, it's kind of like warp 4 in terms of the way that labyrinths were designed before, but I'd really like to go to warp 10, and the computer will let me do that.
Well, we're out of time, Mary. Thank you so much for joining me today. I can't wait to meet you and see these incredible designs at the gathering. It's my intention to enlighten labyrinth neophytes and support labyrinth veterans with guests like you who provide a depth of information and personal experience not available through other sources. So many blessings on your path, and I look so forward to meeting you in a couple of weeks.
Okay. You know, your questions were spot on. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, and spread the word.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Labyrinth in the News in the Life category on blogtalkradio.com with your host, Christiana. Join me on October 18th at 1 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time when my guest will be Helen Curry, one of the founders of the Labyrinth Society, who has an active prison ministry, labyrinth ministry, and a minister, and she also loves conducting weddings on the labyrinth. So join us as we discuss these topics on Labyrinth in the News. Have a blessed week in Lakesh.